Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Patty G Show. This week, we have a special Father's Day edition. That's right. I've got my dad sitting in the chair next to me. We're going to learn about a little bit of where kind of I came from, my background of being raised in an entrepreneurial household and really the businesses that he's got and what he does today and kind of just that journey of how we got here. So I'm very excited to have him on, very honored to have my dad sitting next to me in the show chair and learning about his story from his own eyes. You know, it's kind of cool to see what your parents do every day, but it's a little different to hear about what they do in a setting similar to this. But before we get into all that, I want to give a big, wonderful shout out and thank you to the amazing folks that bring you this show each and every week. Building 5, Philia Real Estate, Lakeman's Health Center, Horizon Financial Group, Mercedes-Benz of Baton Rouge, Currency Bank, the bank for business owners, our newest and latest sponsor, Mimosa Handcrafted Jewelry, and you know our outfit of the day is always brought to you by McClavey Limited. Without further ado, Dad, Mr. Douglas Grimion, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
I'm excited to have you on and learn about or have everybody else learn about your story of who you are and what it is that you do.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So who are you and what the heck do you do?
Well, that's a loaded question, I guess. I'm Doug Grimion. I'm the son of Margaret and Jim Grimion, my parents. I am the husband of Patrice, which is my wife of 42 years. I'm a father of 5. I am a grandfather of 4 with 2 on the way. And I own a couple of businesses.
Okay.
In a nutshell, I guess, a Catholic, and that's about it.
I love it. So that's family man first and foremost.
Absolutely. Family is most important after God.
Yeah. So, and it's tough to balance that within business operations and making things work.
It is. It's been a journey. Of course, I am in my later years, I guess, of the business part of my life. So I've kind of backed off of that somewhat. So I've got some help doing that with a couple of my sons that are working with me in the businesses. So I'm still there 40 hours a week, but the physical labor and work is not as strong as it used to be for me, I'd say 20 years ago. So,
and what is the business? What is it that you do?
Let's see. Well, I guess Grimion Mechanical came about from originally my grandfather, who started Glow Plumbing Company back in the late 40s, early 50s, him and a partner of his, which he ended up buying out. And my father went to the Korean War, and after the Korean War, he came back, and his father passed away early in life at 50-something years old. So my dad and my uncle took over Glow Plumbing, and they carried Glow Plumbing on for up until 1987. And as a child growing up, I would work for Dad during the summers, I guess from probably age 14 through college. I worked for him every summer, every day that he could get me out there. I was out there working for him. And in 1987, we started Grimion Mechanical, Dad and I did. Now, at that time, I was also a civil engineer. I went to engineering school at LSU, graduated in 82, and worked for 4 very good-sized firms in my career. The last job that I did with the firm was actually the bridge that goes down to Grand Isle, which was a very interesting project for us. I was the construction manager, basically, for the construction of that bridge. So that was a very interesting thing. And then after that, I did a little stint for myself for a little while. And then I guess around, 2009 or so, I took on Grimion Mechanical full-time. And that's whenever we started doing Grimion Mechanical full-time. We had a little spent there. I think we had talked about it a little earlier during the Katrina. We did some work down in Katrina, which was very interesting.
We went,
We went from a mom and pop operation, kind of, you know, 5-6 employees to over 40 something employees to fill the need that they needed down after that hurricane, which was a very interesting and stressful 6 months of my wife and I's life to make that transition to that. But after that, we started working full-time Grimion Mechanical, got into the industrial sector, and have been in the industrial sector since 2013. So we've been very blessed.
A decade.
right at a decade. Yeah, been there right at 10 years. We've been very blessed. And a couple of years ago, back in 2018, we started a second business that does industrial groundskeeping, which is another venture that we've started. So I guess basically I'm a two-business kind of household there, trying to make all that panned out and everything. So
growing up with Grant, your dad, Papal to me, you were working with him every summer, but went to college for civil engineering. What was the
correct
draw to civil engineering?
That was the only engineering that didn't have to take organic chemistry.
Okay.
So that's why I went into civil engineering. But once I got into engineering, I really enjoyed the aspects of civil engineering, the design, the build, you know, the different things that, as growing up, being a handy kind of a guy, you know, working around dad, going from construction to civil engineering was a smooth transition, because in my engineering career, I did just about everything that you can think of in civil engineering, from designing parking lots to drainage to bridges to buildings to you name it. You know, we did dock surveys. It just was a plethora of things that I was able to put my hands in the engineering field. Loved it. Did that for about 28 years. So had a full career in the engineering field. Got licensed, I think, around year 2000, I think. I can't remember. I think that's the graduating 82, 4 years. Yeah, somewhere around after Stephanie was born. No, so it would have been around 89.
Yeah. 89, okay.
89, somewhere okay. In that area. And did engineering for quite a while, and just, you know, was still doing engineering full time and trying to do the family business. And it was just too much. I was dying a quick death.
Yeah.
And so my wife and I made a decision of what we wanted to do. And we felt that being self-employed was the way we wanted to go. And it made sense for our family. And that's the way we went. And again, we've been very blessed with that decision. So
what was the first project you worked on as a civil engineer? As a PE.
Well, the very first job was with HNTB, which was a large engineering firm. And at that time, they were the design consultants for I-49.
Okay.
So we reviewed all of the drawings for I-49, and we were responsible for a couple of sections of that roadway. Well, this is going way back now. I want to say Boyce was one of the sections we did, and we did another section at Cross Lake. So we actually did the design of those two sections, but we reviewed all the drawings for I-49 from Lafayette all the way up to Shreveport.
Okay. So it was split up to different sections for design and review phases.
Different sections, different companies designed those sections, but we reviewed the whole roadway portion of the project and bridges. So everything went through our office before it went out for construction.
Okay, so you had experience in the roadway review, roadway, design,
roadway,
everything.
Yes, design, bridges, the whole nine yards, yes.
Okay, and so then you kind of, were you drawn more to bridges over the course, or that's just kind of where the career path went?
No, actually, my career path went more toward the road design and the drainage aspects of it, because after HNTB, I went to work for an environmental firm and did a bunch of work for them, and we had a civil engineering group there, and I worked for a gentleman that was probably one of the better engineers that I've ever worked for in my life. Just a very fine man. His name was Lamy Chopin. Just a super guy. I really enjoyed working for him. Taught me quite a bit of stuff. And actually, at that firm is when I got registered. And the first, I guess, job that I was responsible for, he could tell that I was very nervous about it. So we actually co-stamped the drawing. So he took responsibility with me on those drawings, which I thought was, as a mentor, was...
Does that happen normally?
Not really, but there was different sections that we were able to go with, and he made sure that he reviewed everything that we did, and so he was comfortable with it, and I was definitely comfortable with his backing of it. So, and then from there, I did a stint at another firm that we had a... If you're going to do engineering work, the job that I had was pretty nice. I don't know if you were old enough to remember this, but that was when we had the boat.
Yes.
So I inspected fender systems on bridges on the Intercoastal Canal.
What's a fender system?
is the wooden structures that are underneath the bridges that keeps the barges from hitting the structures.
Okay.
So we were responsible for making sure that those things were safe for bridges, for the bridge, and for the boats that traveled it. And if they ever hit one, we had an 8-hour response time that we had to go out and inspect the bridges. And then once we inspected them, we would write a report, assess the damages, and then we would send it to the boat owners, and they would have to pay the damages for the state.
So they would actually collect.
Absolutely.
When a boat hit a bridge. I didn't know that.
And before we had done it, they had never been able to collect before because they didn't have what we called a baseline survey. So we did baseline surveys to get the condition of all the fender systems. And from there, any accidents, we had previous knowledge of the how the structure was, you know, the condition it was in. So we were able to, from those initial reports, develop any incidents that happened, and then they were held liable for.
So that was like a new thing y'all kind of pioneered?
Very much new. It was the first time it had ever been done, and we did it for about 3.5 years. And then they started doing it in-house after the contract was for a 3-year contract.
What do you mean in-house?
They did it within the DOTD themselves.
Oh, okay.
They did it in-house. So they no longer used an outside engineering firm. They did everything in-house at the different district levels. It was basically the 3 major districts was District 2, 7, and I think 61 was the 3 districts that we worked for. So.
Gotcha. And so you would have to go out in a boat and inspect all this.
It was a tough job.
In South Louisiana. Yep. So.
And there were several of them that we keep during hunting season so we could make sure that they – it just worked out well. We'll just leave it at that. It just worked out well. But from there, then, of course, I went to the last firm that I worked with, and we did the big bridge down to Grand Isle, which is standing today. It's how they get down to and from there with the toll bridges and everything, which was a very interesting project. And actually, one of the firms that helped us on that project is the firm that your wife works for.
Yeah.
And so we've carried that legacy.
The guy still works there.
Absolutely.
That you worked with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Robbie Lear was a very good friend of mine, and he did most of the geometrics on that bridge, and we had quite some conversations about those geometrics. So
we have a listening audience outside of Louisiana, and so for the bridge itself, can you kind of describe what that – because I'm thinking of just a normal bridge over a small little canal, but this was not. This was actually something really, really incredible that was designed and built.
It was a unique design. To start with, the structure that goes over Bayou Lafourche, I'm not sure if it still is, but at the time it was one of the largest spanning structures, I want to say in the country, but I could be wrong. But it was quite the type of structure that was built was one that was – it pushed all limits. The type of construction for the roadway was what we call end-on construction. So you had to we couldn't build a channel in the water down the middle of the bridge to build from because of the environmental impacts and stuff for the bridge. So you did what was called an end-on construction. You actually built a fake bridge on the side of it where all your equipments could run on. And then as you build, you built from what you previously built. So you would drive piles, which were all friction piles that just went down 150, 160 feet because they didn't hit nothing. And then you would construct everything with the two strands on the outside of the bridge where all your equipment would stay on, and you built as you went. So all your equipment came from the land-based out and not just from the water up, which was a different type of construction, which is called end-on construction. So,
and how long is that bridge?
Oh, from Leeville down to Grand Isle, I want to say it's probably about 5 or 6 miles, and it's my understanding that I think that they are actually building back up to Golden Meadow now. So they're putting in the second phase of that structure from Golden Meadow to Leeville, and then from Leeville down to Grand Isle. So
okay, and that helped them avoid all the hurricane situations with LA1 and all that.
It was built for the people of Grand Isle to be able to evacuate during hurricanes. It was above the water, so when the water started rising, it wouldn't influx the road, so they were able to get out. Yes.
Gotcha. So and then moving from that project being your last project, you did your little own stint mm-hmm. in engineering, and what kind of work were you doing there?
With that, we were actually involved with doing some of the debris cleanups and stuff that was done in certain parishes, and that was after Gustav. So okay. I did some environmental stuff with the Corps of Engineers and those people. So it was mostly environmental type work that I did there.
Okay.
wasn't a very long assignment. And then once it was over with, that's when my wife and I decided that we would stick with and decided to go with industrial plumbing. And it's been a good move for us. I think it's been a good move for the family. It's been a good move for our business. And I, like I said, I've got a couple of sons that are taking over. Of course, you being an accountant, you know, you do help with the business, but in a different role. But we have two sons. I have two sons that are each taking over one of the businesses. And actually, Philip, the one who will take over Grimion Mechanical, will be the fourth generation of Grimion or of the plumbing side of the business. So
and when Globe started, was it what type of plumbing was it doing?
Mostly what my grandfather did was residential, and he did some commercial, but it was mostly residential plumbing. And then with my dad and his brother took it over, they went more light commercial with some residential. They did more apartment complexes. Of course, that was back in the 70s when Baton Rouge was starting to really blossom. So apartment complexes, a lot of the commercial buildings that you see around town, it was hard to get in a vehicle with my dad and ride around town and him not say, I did that building, I did that building. You know, we did the plumbing. You know, so his master plumbing license was 524. So there was only 500 master plumbers prior to him, whereas mine is 2949.
Yeah, and what's Phillips?
And Phillips is in the 12,000.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the progression of plumbers since, you know, my dad's time, and I have no idea what my grandfather's was, so.
When didn't he invent a threader?
He did. He and my grandfather invented what he called the Grim 8, G-R-E-M-8, which was a self-oiling hand die threader that he invented, where you would put the oil in the handle of the apparatus, and he went through the whole patent process. I've actually have it hanging in my office with all the patent information, everything. The only bad thing about it was is right after he invented it, they came out with the electric with the electric pony, so you could do all the stuff that he was doing manually, electronically. So it didn't sell a whole bunch.
Well, and I mean, at the time, people were having to do things differently without his device. It was not
correct.
Far out. I mean, it was not this thing that was quickly made and then.
No. Prior to his invention, it was a two-man operation. You had one man that would hand thread and one man had to oil it to keep the teeth of the thread from burning and getting too hot. So it was a two-man process, whereas what he invented, one man could do the work, and there was just a button on the end of it that he could push that would self-oil the machine. So he kind of short-circuited the process for it, and it was going to be a big hit. But the electric vice came along, and thanks to Ridget, he didn't do too well after that.
But, I mean, I still think, like, designing that concept and coming up with something like that is fascinating. I mean, nowadays you think and you look at how it's done, it's all electric, and
right.
Nobody sees anything that – but taking yourself back into that time period it was revolutionary to the point where it was saving. You almost were able to do twice the amount of work with one person threading and another person running pipe.
Correct. It was a big time saver. The only thing that I can relate it to back in that day was everything was done with cast iron pipe, and all the joints were made with lead joints. They were all oakumed and lead joints, and then from there, some individual and said, hey, we can put a gasket in these things and it would work twice as fast. And he was correct. So what my grandfather did was revolutionize the pipe threading industry, which was the same thing that a gentleman did with lead joints to gasket joints. Yeah. And now we have PVC and glue. And so it's now you have, you know, ProPress. There's 16 different ways you can do things nowadays. It's you feel like you've been cheated when you come through the old school, and now you have these kids coming up that couldn't make a lead joint if they had to, but that's part of the game.
That's what I was about to ask is in talking with Philip, who is my brother, who is now running the plumbing company with you, what were the differences in the testing for when you sat for the exam? Because there's, from my understanding, there's a written portion of the exam and there's a practical portion of the exam.
Correct. The written portion, I don't think has changed much. It's mostly the code. So we both had to learn the codes and that type of questioning. But in the written part, when I took it, we had to make a lead joint, you had to make a solder joint, and you also had to put together a flush valve from the New Orleans prison that was probably 1930-ish vintage that they gave you a schematic from that didn't even look like the thing that you had. And as far as I know, Philip didn't have to do that. They had to do a little rough in with some PVC pipe, take some measurements on some things. They did have to make a solder joint, but nothing with lead or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, even when I was helping you when I was 15, 16, 17, and 18, I learned how to solder.
Right.
When we were running copper pipe, doing stub outs and all that for houses. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, the technology that y'all are using is ridiculous.
Well, there's PEX, and so you have, you know, fittings that you don't even have to, they just, you know, snap together. And then we have some machinery that's called, we call it pro pressing, and you can actually, we can take a line that still has water in it that's not even finished draining 4-inch carbon steel, and we can put it together without it being dry. So,
and that is, I mean, I remember we would have to do pressure tests, and if there was a leak, you'd have to drain the entire building, get it completely bone dry, and then sit there with a torch, get it glowing hot, and then run the flux and then run the solder.
That's correct.
Before you could do anything. So it was something that y'all can do now in, I assume, less than 2 minutes.
Oh, yeah. It's very quick.
It was a two-hour process.
It's amazing the speed at which things are done now, and I guess technology is what it is, and it's going to continue to improve. But, you know, there's still places where the old school has to come in.
Sure.
And they still have to call on dad to go in there and show them how to do that, because they've never seen some stuff before. Where we work at, there's some buildings that are fairly old and they have old stuff in it. And so, you know, can you come take a look at this? Because we're not real sure what we're looking at here. So we still get that.
Well, I mean, even in my house in Southdown or in Mid-City here, it's an older home built in the 40s or 50s. I don't know when. But when we had an issue, we had a whole cypress root in the pipe, and I called you, and we started looking, and it was concrete pipe, and I had never seen concrete pipe ever before, but it just was what they used back in the day.
Well, they went from under the house, which is cast iron. Usually they either went to concrete or terracotta, which went to the city. And then, of course, now we have the abilities to line those old pipes,
right?
Which is a whole nother avenue that we're pursuing, which really just – it's a game changer. I mean, you can take, like, for instance, your house pipes under your house, and we can line those pipes without taking them out of service in a day and give you right out a 50-year guarantee that your pipes will be good for the next 50 years. So
how did you find out about this?
That was, we were at the industrial site that we work at, and the gentleman that I worked for approached me and says, "Doug, have you ever heard about internal lining of pipes?" And I told him, I says, "No, I've never really heard that, but let me look into it." So we looked into it, and we found a company down in Tampa, Florida, that was producing this stuff. And so I asked the guy, I says, "You know, this is something that, is this something that you're truly interested in?" And he says, "Well, yeah, we've got some need for it, but I need to know more about it." I says, "Well, there's a company down in Tampa, and I don't mind going down there and investing in this, but I know you can't give me no guarantee, but the investment is quite large." So he says, "Well," he says, "you know, go see what you can learn." So we went down there and we called him, and my son and I went down and we spent about a week down there looking at different things. And he called me up when I was down there and he says, "How's it going?" I says, "Well, we're fixing to head back to Baton Rouge with the equipment." And he says, "Well, good, because when you come back, I got a job for you." I says, "Really?" So we had to stop, and there's some training that we had to bring someone back with us, but we didn't set it up because we didn't have a job, and I didn't want to waste it without a job. So we had to make some things happen, and we were able to do that. And we've done quite a few jobs with, you know, the client that we have, and some outside work. And it's a very it's not a real cheap fix, but it's a fix where it's a non-invasive fix. You don't have to tear anything up. All I need is a 3x3 hole. I can get in and we can do the work on an existing house. We can go back in and reinstate the existing pipes. So it's just a process that is, of course, it's changing all the time because they're coming up with new products. Now they're coming up with patches. The stuff that we have to ambient cure. They're now coming up with stuff that you can heat cure. Now they're coming up with UV cures. It's an ongoing process. We bought another piece of equipment that we can internally line culverts up to 36-inch in diameter culverts, 400 feet long if we have to. Of course, the material to handle that is quite heavy, so it takes
you mean
big
a crane
machinery
or something.
We have you know, different types of equipment that picks the stuff up. We buy the liner already resined out. That's in a ice bath, and so it's a long process. You have these big heaters that you have to heat it's quite an ordeal.
What would warrant that type of repair?
We had the job that we just finished was a culvert that was under the main road going into this facility. So the culvert was failing on them because the road was starting to sag, and they could see when it would rain, it would get inundated, and they were having to patch the side of the road. So their option was to shut this road down, put in a bypass road, which would require a second railroad crossing, which is very hard to get from the railroad. The railroad does not want you crossing their tracks at all. So they don't want no additional crossings. So they'd had to build a bypass road. They'd had to cross a railroad. They'd had to tear the road up, fix the culvert, and put the road back in service, which would have probably taken, I'm going to say, several weeks to do this. And we went in overnight and repaired their culvert for them in less than a 12-hour period. We had it repaired for them. Never stopped traffic and never, you know, there was never
anything.
Never disruption to their plant. And this was the main road going into the facility. So 18-wheelers, you know, everybody that went in, contract workers, the whole nine yards. And we started one afternoon, and by the next morning at the morning shift, we were gone.
And it's not only just like lining these pipes, it's kind of reinforcing them and providing more strength.
It doesn't provide additional strength, but it doesn't, it keeps the strength where it is. So they now, and then we actually extended the culvert out 50 more feet so that they could slope the road off, so they wouldn't have such a vertical drop on the sides of the road and everything. We would like to see it used with storm drains. You can go from manholes to manholes on storm drains, just any type of open, you know, the railroad. How many equalizer pipes are underneath the railroad that they drain water from one side of the railroad to the other? So the use of this equipment is endless. It's just, as you would know, it's a marketing thing. You have to be able to market this and get out there and get in front of people. So
when for stuff like that, it's almost like a municipal thing as well.
It's absolutely
getting the city to invest the capital to repair and run the maintenance that should be done already.
That's
on
correct.
This infrastructure.
And instead of them having to dig stuff up, as long as it's not collapsed, we can reinforce it for them and give them a new pipe. Municipalities, school districts, anything that has, you know, a lot of storm drains or sewer lines, big sewer lines and stuff like that, it's a definite a win-win for everybody.
So even like straight up holes in the pipes that they have, it's able to just
Long as it's not collapsed. If it's if it's an open pipe and there's something that's missing, if it's not a 7-foot miss, if it's only a couple of inches, the one that we just finished, there was about a 14-inch gap that the bottom of the pipe was completely gone. But yet the dirt was still in the proper shape of the pipe. We were able to line straight through that and give them a pipe back where there was no pipe.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, and that's not only saving man hours, that's just saving operations as a whole. I mean, if your main road's shut down, you cannot, and a plant never wants to be closed.
No, and this was inside of a building, so they'd have had to bust the concrete in the building. They'd have to take walls down. They'd have to, you know, the people would have had to get out. It was in their kitchen area where their, you know, control room is. So it was a quick fix for them for probably, I don't know, a third or so of the money that it would have cost them to do it the traditional way.
Gotcha. So and before getting into all this, you said that your grandfather was doing residential, and then your dad kind of moved into residential and commercial. Mm-hmm. And so when you picked it up, where were y'all at?
Were still doing commercial. We were doing commercial, but the industry at that time, the construction industry, was very, I'm going to say, volatile, for lack of a better word of it. A lot of contractors out there, a lot of people doing work, a lot of people doing work for next of nothing. So it was very hard to, you know, you had to have a lot of crews doing a lot of work to really turn a profit in that. So we just, and it was at the time where, you know, contractors weren't getting paid. It was just a bad deal all the way around. And I didn't care to go through that because, you know, we'd had some lean times and I didn't want to go through those again. And so my wife and I decided that we were going to take a different route. And actually my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, got us involved in the industrial sector because he was doing work in the plants. And so he was very helpful to us in getting us, you know, started with the safety programs and the different things that we needed to get in there. And we went in as a subcontractor in the industry. And then after about a year and a half of being a subcontractor, the same gentleman who got us involved with the lining part of this, of our company, asked me if we would work directly for them. And, you know, I said, yeah, as long as y'all going to pay us, we're good. and we have, we've been again, and we do work, you know, we do work in the industrial sector. We do work for some different school districts. So we do a lot of backflow work, which is another, I think you actually were doing backflows for us at one time. You were licensed to do, to test backflow. So
y'all sent me to Austin for three or four days to go and get licensed.
So we've expanded what my father's vision of the company was. And my son has a larger vision probably than I ever will too, because there's some things that he wants to get involved with that we are doing now, but we're having to rent some of the equipment that we're using. And he's got a big vision of what he likes. His background is in construction management. So he's got that background that he wants to do different stuff. So we're mucking out ditches, we're cleaning culverts, we're, you know, cleaning catch basins, but you know, all that takes a lot of, it seems like everything he wants to do is a large capital investment. And it's just, I'm still from the old school, you know, I have to have the work before I want to spend the money. And it's a tough balance there with him.
Well, and it's led into that from what your experience was. I mean, and going through the rough times within the commercial where you didn't know 30, 60, 90, 120, 365, if ever.
Yeah.
I mean, there were situations that came. And so it is that, you know, that reserve mindset of we can't do that capital outlay unless we have the work to fulfill it. But I mean, what he's seeing is more of this, well, where we're at now, we're able to expand and do X,
correct,
Y, and Z. And ultimately it's the industry as a whole allows for that, because plumbing's kind of a dying industry with not a lot of people going into it.
Well, and that's true. And a lot of your trades are like that. A lot of the trades are a dying, people don't want to have a trade because they don't want to do the manual labor. So it's hot out there today. It's 105 index out there, and it takes a special person to want to do that. I've got a bunch of people that want to work for me, but very few that want to do the work. They just want to show up. And so you fight that battle, as a lot of people do. And, you know, then at the same facility, we had an opportunity with the second business, and this was during the COVID time, when everything was scaling back and they weren't getting none of their stuff done. And we were approached to, if we were able or wanted to even pursue doing their groundskeeping stuff. The gentleman that I have that basically runs that with my other son, we talked about it. We formed a company. And again, I think it's my wife's prayers that we've done very well though with that business as well. So that's another opportunity. You know, and the son that runs that is an attorney. You know, go figure.
But it's full circle, though, because when I had turned 11 and Aaron had turned 16,
mm-hmm,
I guess I was kind of roped into it because I needed a third person. Her mom always said, don't leave your little brother behind, one of the two. And they were like, let's do something this summer, because they didn't want to do plumbing, or I don't know what the reasoning or rationale, mm-hmm, was, but we wanted to do a lawn company.
Yep.
And so it's interesting to see how it's kind of come full circle, where we did that when he turned 16, had a truck, and y'all loaned us money for a lawn equipment till, yep, we could do it, under one condition: we had to keep y'all's yard perfectly manicured every single week. That was the deal. That was the finance term.
The good old days.
The good old days. And we'll provide you equipment, but you got to keep our yard looking as good, and you can't miss a week.
That's right.
But then it's coming full circle, where, yep, now it's doing it on a much grander scale, both have eyes of larger equipment, more capital outlay.
And again, with big equipment, everything costs money. So, I mean, you know, who would ever thought that I'd have owned a 120 horsepower tractor with a 15-foot batwing trailer on, you know, bush hog on the back of it?
I mean,
but we do.
Who ever thought you'd be doing industrial landscaping
being
a civil engineer at LSU?
That's right. You're right. So it's, you know, I guess my eyes were opened in different avenues from my sons. You know, I guess I'm fortunate that all of y'all have wanted to, I guess we could call them entrepreneurs, because, you know, Philip didn't want to work for somebody else, as neither did Aaron. As you know, you do work for an accounting firm, but you also see the benefits of other things. So it's, you know, it's a blessing that the kids and the family have done their own thing. My daughter, she's self-employed herself. My younger daughter, getting there. So it's interesting that you lay a foundation for your kids, and some of it sticks. So it's I guess it's a good feeling that, you know, what you've done in your life, that your kids see some form of success, and they don't mind pursuing something of the same thing, which is.
Well, and I think it's kind of the environment that we were raised in led to that out of the box thinking that you don't really have this limitation set on you to go through and do whatever you got to do and then go work for somebody. You have this opportunity before you to do whatever you want. You know, right. I think that was kind of the environment we were raised in. And my mindset was, well, there's, you know, the world's your oyster, go shuck it however you want to do it.
That's right.
And not be bound to one set of things for however long you want to do. And it's kind of entrepreneurship was that way to figure out what you wanted to do, and it opened up a whole avenue to anything and everything. You know, you could do anything from plumbing or in landscaping, or heck, we're sitting in chairs filming and having a company out of this.
Very uncomfortable here, but that's okay. And it's true. Your limitations are set by yourself. And as long as you don't have no limitations on your abilities, which is a good thing. You know, I don't think that we ever stifled any of our kids' ideas that they had. And of course, you know, growing up, you know, some of y'all friends didn't like the way that y'all had things to do prior to when y'all went and did stuff with them. But it was just the way that, you know, we thought we needed to raise y'all. And I don't know, I guess every time somebody hits me with that, I just say, well, look at them, they didn't turn out too bad. So,
well, and it's that element of getting your work done before you go and have leisure time it's stuck with me. And it's I have my son doing the same thing. Before we eat dinner, he's got to put his shoes up. He's got to put his clothes in the dirty clothes, and then we can eat dinner. You know, it's
never too young.
Building that routine of getting your work done and then you can have your playtime later.
Correct.
It's not a bad trait to have.
No.
You know, and understanding that there aren't limitations, I'm sure, is kind of what led into what y'all started doing within Katrina, where there was an opportunity to go, whether it be a short period of time or a long period of time. I mean, at that point, y'all were a mom and pop. Y'all had a handful of employees.
Four at the most. And we went, within a week, we had 45 people working.
Which is nuts.
Of course, again, this all stems back to my wife's brother. He was the company that he owned was doing this work, and he asked me if I wanted to get involved with it. And I wasn't sure, because he was telling me what we were going to need to do. And I'm trying to run the numbers on this in my head as an engineer going through this. And I'm thinking, you know, we're going to have more people on payroll, and we're going to do more money in a week than we were doing in a quarter. And the numbers were just, to keep up was mind boggling to me. And of course, you know, we had to, you know, finance some different things. We put some different stuff up, collateral, and I was a bunch of sleepless nights. And I met with her brother, and I says, Mark, I says, we got to get paid for this. I'm just letting you know, we need to get paid for them. He assured me that we would. And we did. And, I think you were helping us at the time. We were cutting up PVC. We had 18 wheelers at the house bringing pipe
would
cut up, load in trailers, and bring down to New Orleans with fittings. And we were doing that two or three times a week.
So, and for those listening, what was the work that y'all were doing? It was a specific
set of work. We were actually
involved
in setting up the trailers for Katrina, and we were not limited to New Orleans. We did it in New Orleans. We did it in Grand Isle. We did it in Jefferson Parish. Orleans Parish, we did it in Baton Rouge with the trailer parks. Anything that involved plumbing to get these people back up and running at some type of normalcy with some type of a home, we got involved with. We did work down in Tulane that flooded. We did a ton of work at Tulane. We did some work down at a big place in what's on the other side of New Orleans, towards Slidell area. So we just got involved with a bunch of work at Katrina and bunch of sleepless nights, but it was good work. It was good money. And you know, we thought we were helping people to get back with their lives as they could, because these people were hurting. I mean, they didn't have nothing, no place to live. And you go down to a place like Grand Isle and you're helping these people get situated back up, and these people were offering you some lunches and stuff, and you would look around and say, you know, what are you going to feed this state? Because they had nothing. I mean, they literally had nothing after this hurricane. And so it was a kind of a feel-good thing. It was very profitable, but it was a feel-good thing that you were helping people get back on their feet. And I guess we did that the end of 2005 and the first 3 months into 2006. And then, of course, that waned off. But for those 6 months, it was a lot of hustling going on, a lot of family involvement.
It was a lot.
I mean, we would get 18-wheelers of pipe delivered to the house that we would unload with my father-in-law's tractor.
Mm-hmm.
And then we cut it in half and cases of fittings, and we'd load them on trailers. And we'd leave at 10 o'clock at night, drive to New Orleans, drop this stuff off to my workers, and we'd come back home and start the next day working again. And this went on and on for, like I said, 6 months. So,
because in 05 and 06, I think that's close to the time that we started getting homeschooled. And so we were helping in between sessions and actually cutting, and because you would almost prefab some of the work, some of the fittings that you knew had to happen.
Correct.
That way it would cut down on the time in the field where people could just lay it. Because it wasn't there a point in time where somebody would walk up and say, you need a worker? You said, can you glue pipe? And everything goes downhill.
That's right. Can you glue pipe and put on a garden hose? And that was, you know, that's what we were doing. And I mean, we turn over 30-something trailers a day. So it was, you know, it was a lot of work, a lot of paperwork to keep everything right, to make sure. Then, of course, you know, like I said, we were a sub under my brother-in-law, and thank the good Lord all that worked out. It really did. So, but.
So, and then at that point in time, it was moving out. What's the next phase? And backflows kind of started coming into the picture in the 08, 09 era?
When I went full-time doing plumbing and still kept my engineering license, still do to this day. But we also looked into backflows because I knew that there was – I went to college with an individual that owns backflow prevention here in Baton Rouge, and we got to talking about different things. And so I went through his program and became licensed to test, install, and repair backflows. And then we started making some calls to some different chains and, you know, the Eckerd Drugs, the Walmarts, and the Sam's and things like that. And we established ourselves a base of clients to test backflows. Then you got licensed to test backflows. I think at the time Philip did.
Mm-hmm.
And so we
y'all two went together.
Right. We went down to Florida to do that testing. And so we had that as another niche in our business. So that was kind of the pay the bills kind of a thing, that it was a good fit for us that we could do that on the side and still have the plumbing business. And of course, we were trying to get all this put together. Philip, I don't remember when he graduated college, but, you know, we were trying to make all this happen, trying to put all this together. Then he was deciding what he wanted to do. And It was a lot going on at that time. And, you know, I guess looking back, you know, it's hard to remember the real bad times because, again, we've been blessed. And so we've come out on the other end of it. And I think for the most part, we've helped some people and we've done some things that we wanted to do. There's a lot that still needs to be done that Phillips still wants to do. And, you know, sometimes I got to rein him in. You know, we looked at a job today, and it was a construction kind of job he wanted to look at. And I mean, I'm running the numbers on this thing, and Philip, we're not ready for that yet. We're not. Well, Dad, that's just not a good attitude, you know, that kind of a deal. So, but the money still has to come from somewhere.
That's right.
And so,
it's even if it's a high-end paying job, you still have to front it as a
sub.
Oh,
it was quite a bit of profit, but it was I'm not sure I would have wanted to pay the bonding that would have had to go for this job. So,
well, and I think that in the construction industry and the plumbing industry is that component that not a lot of folks see this other side of, where right. they see a project happening, they go, okay, there was bids here, and the people won the bid, and it's moving on and moving past. But what it is for a smaller organization that doesn't have 100, 200 employees, mm-hmm. you have to really evaluate, am I willing to bet the farm on this?
Right.
And one project has that potential to do it, and it could, it could pay out in the end, but it's...
Well, and with my engineering background, you know, we've been able to do some different things in the plumbing industry that some other companies can't, because there's a lot of things that the clients will look at us and ask us to prepare for them. Like, you know, we started these inserts that we put in into treatment plants and stuff, that we can do it now where there's no, you don't have to get no confined space entries and things like that. So we've kind of developed a niche in that area as well, with my background in engineering and with Phillip's background in construction management. We put together some packages that are benefiting some clients. And again, it's, you know, do you either tear it up and build a whole new one, or do you refine your technology and put in a new system? And now you've got something that you don't have to get nobody in any kind of danger situations when you're changing pumps out and things like that. And again, something that's, you know, these niches are what you want to find. You want to find something that people need, and there's not a whole bunch of people that provide it, and not a specialty item.
Yeah.
You want something that's, you know, an everyday thing that somebody needs. You know, I mean, I guess you look back at the invention of the rubber band. or the little sticky note, you know, things like that people use on a daily basis, don't think of where they came from, but yet everybody uses them. You know, if you could find something that you could go into Tiger Stadium and get $1 from everybody that goes there, how much money could you make in a year?
Pretty good bit.
So, you know, so that's what it, niches is what you, is what I like to consider that we do. We're a specialty plumbing contracting company that we can do several different things for you that you don't have to go abroad, because there's numerous times during the day that people will call me and ask me my opinion on things in the engineering light because of my background. So
yeah, and you've seen, you know, like you said, you've
a
seen
lot.
So much.
I've seen a lot,
whether it's through plumbing or through engineering, just your experience,
right.
And you can't. It's hard to replace that.
Yep,
it's, you don't get all those years back just by hiring somebody fresh. It's like, well, that takes years and years to build. And some of the things will never be seen until you're doing a renovation or a repair on an old structure. You know, 10 years from now, you could have somebody looking at something and pulling up a structure and saying, I don't know how in the world they did this.
Right.
And then you got to call on somebody who was doing the work at the time.
We had that situation yesterday, that bad leak, couldn't find the valve to shut it off with. They had to call a man that's retired. And he said, there's a box over in the corner. It's labeled electrical, but it's not electrical. There's a valve underneath it. And sure enough, they had water coming out of a 16-inch main for 2.5 days till they found this valve to shut it off. So, you know, experience.
Wow.
The thing that you're saying is, you know, the experience that people have, you know, it's I guess it's not priceless, but it's worth a lot of money to know things.
It essentially is priceless. If something is labeled one way,
yeah,
and it was done,
and you don't know it.
And it's because, again, when you're doing construction or you're building something, you tend to not think about the future folks using it in times. And so
right.
you're saying, what do I need to do right here, right now to resolve this? Okay, we're going to do this. And then somebody mislabels, like, oh, I'm always going to be here. I'm going to know that this is right here.
I know where the valve is.
I know where the valve is. Don't you worry. We don't need to put it in the drawings. And then stuff like that happens frequently.
Yep. It does. More times than you would think. So
with the advancing of technology, I know it can be a bumpy road to navigate and say, are we going to add this piece of tech? Are we going to add this piece of tech? When do we make that investment? What has kind of been one of the biggest shifts for you within the technology space within plumbing? Now, you didn't think 10 years ago you'd ever be able to do what you're doing.
At this point in time, it would be the lining portion of our company. Never heard of it before. Never thought we would be able to do it. And found the concept, went down, met with the people, was very intrigued with it. Phillip jumped all over it. He just, of course, you know, it's computer driven. There's different things that you have to use in it. I mean, with him cutting some of these pipes out is like a video game. He's got this board, he watches a camera, and of course that's not my bag of tea. So that, I guess, over the years has been one of the bigger changes for me from traditional type plumbing to something that you could give people that's a non-invasive correction of a problem that helps them, and the technology is still evolving. You know, we're trying to get them to produce a product that is pressure sensitive and also chemical sensitive. Because if we could do that, that would even open up more doors for clients to do stuff like cooling towers. If they have a cooling tower that has a certain chemical in it, then they can't, you can't repair that pipe with nothing except replacing it. So you got to shut the cooling tower down. You got to do this kind of stuff. But if we could come up with a material that is adaptive to the chemicals that they're putting in there, then you've got a fix for them. So the technology of the liner stuff to me is very interesting. Very few people down here are doing it currently. So again, you know, we've got a little small niche of something that has a great potential for our company.
And it's almost kind of changing how people look at the lens of what does a plumber do.
Right. Oh, absolutely. You know, yes.
It's not your typical call somebody and he's going to walk in with a plunger and look all torn up and ragged out. You know, it's
correct.
Totally changing the view on what is the plumbing industry.
Well, and it changes the view on people who buy in older homes.
Yeah.
You know, if they know that they can get something that's, you know, a problem for them fixed at a reasonable cost, then it opens up the avenue for them to buy that property and, you know, not say, well, as soon as I buy this thing, we're going to have to rip this slab up to fix this problem, whereas we can go in now and fix it without tearing up the slab.
I mean, I know that was one of the comfort factors for Charlotte and I when we were buying a house was, okay, it's an old house. Well, if there's anything wrong with the pipes, we can always just line the whole thing. It's not a big deal. We can fix it. It's not a concern. And that's, you know, another part of what we learned or what y'all taught us as growing up is you've got to be able to figure it out on your own. So if it is 11 o'clock at night, or in my situation a couple of days ago, I had a sink, was my kitchen sink was full after I came back from the gym at 5 a.m. And turns out that my lovely wife decided to put 4 whole chicken breasts down the disposal. And had I not known what to do, I mean, I still made a mess because the bucket was half the size it should have been. And so it was water everywhere. But
got it fixed.
From what y'all had taught us, I learned, and I was able to take apart the P-trap and pull the pipe out and notice the blockage was past it. And so I had to pull it out of the pipe. And I got it back working, thankfully, but.
And didn't tell her nothing.
No, she woke up she could hear me doing things in the kitchen, but she didn't tell me that she had did it until after I fixed it and was cleaning up. And she was graciously mopping the floor. And
there you
I wonder
go.
What caused it. I have no idea.
Not my problem.
But knowing and being raised in an environment where it was, you have to figure it out. Sometimes there won't be situations where you can just call people.
Yep.
I mean, who was I going to call at 5 a.m. to resolve an issue? And when it was just a matter of me dirtying some towels in a bucket, you know?
Well, and I think that is also a dying trait, is people fixing things by themselves. People just, they don't, their lives are so busy that they don't take the time, you know, to figure out how to do things. Of course, you know, everybody's got YouTube now, and you can just about do anything on YouTube these days. I'm not a big fan of it, but it is what it is. I have used it on some vehicles before, but
I was about to say, I have a very fond memory of when I was 16 or 17 and I did a motor swap in the Jeep, and you looked at me and you said, you know how to do this? And I said, nope. And I have my phone right there, and it's like, pull here, do this and do that.
We got it in though.
We figured it out and we got it in. So but still it was that mentality of you got to figure it out. You got to be willing to do something with your hands. And the plumbing industry is one of those things that people aren't going into it as much because they're wanting to not have to do that.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it can be a very lucrative business.
Sure.
If you're willing to put in the man hours and the effort and the labor that's required.
It's a labor intensive business, but people make good livings being plumbers.
I mean, they had a couple months ago, they had a plumber with a billboard, $10,000 signing bonus to anybody that comes and works for us. I mean, it can be very lucrative. The trade industry as a whole can be very lucrative.
Well, it is. I mean, you've got plumbing, you've got electrical, you know, of course, welders these days are making you know, senseless money. They, of course, there's not that many of them. So it's a supply and demand. I mean, you took economics in college. It's just not hard to figure out. But there's still some need for trades, and you're right. I don't think that there's as many people going into the trades as there was back in the day. I mean, when we were in high school, we used to have something in school called shop, and you would actually, you know, learn a trade. You could either learn carpentry, you learn how to weld, you know, you did different things, and that's, I don't think anybody does shop anymore. I think the last place that I went to did some backflows, that was at Plaquemine High School, and they still had a welding shop. So they actually taught welding at Plaquemine High School, you know, which I thought was impressive.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that these, the, you know, they were teaching these kids, giving them a trade if they wanted it when they got out of school. So, you know, they, like you said, the times have changed, the technology. I mean, here we are sitting in a place with, you know, that this used to be, I can't even imagine how this was done in the 70s or 80s, you know, back when they did television and stuff. So it's a big difference. It's a ever-changing world.
Yeah, and it's just going to continue to change. So as we kind of start to wrap up the show, we have set list of questions we ask each and every guest that comes on.
Uh-oh.
The first one is, what is something you did as a kid you wish you could still do today?
Man, that's a loaded question there. Wish I could move like I did when I was a kid. I don't know. There was a lot of things that growing up I did with my father, you know, that we had a bunch of special times together, the hunting and fishing and the different things like that, that I'm trying to pass on with y'all and stuff. But as a kid, you know, having those times with them, I wish I could have some of those times back, the hunting and the fishing and just the outdoor activities that we did with him that I guess molded my life in what it is today.
Yeah. And those are, I mean, you never lose those memories.
No. You don't, and those are the memories you want to keep. I mean, when it's all said and done in the end, it's family. That's about all you got that you can count on, and, you know, you need to make sure that you remember that. And he always did. He always never mind. Go ahead.
No, what was it?
Well, I think I have one of the other questions. I'll answer this one with the other.
Okay. So what are three lessons learned along the way? I mean, you've been in and around family businesses your entire life, from working in them to running them to passing them on. And you've been in engineering as well for 20-some-odd years. So mm-hmm. within all of that, what are three lessons you've kind of gathered along the way?
And I guess that was one thing I was going to say. Number one is you want to treat people the way you want them to treat you. You've always got to be honest with people and fair with them. And if you are, things usually will take care of themselves. I mean, when you tell somebody something, it's a whole lot easier to remember the truth than it is a lie. So when you tell them, whatever it is, if you don't have the answer, I mean, I sat in meetings in engineering, man would ask me a question, I'd look at him and say, sir, I don't have that answer, but I'll get it for you. And he was fine with that. He didn't care that I didn't know, but he knew that I was going to go find the answer and bring it to him. One thing my daddy always told me that I've tried to remember and run my business with is that people don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. And to me, that's always been a statement that's just, I mean, if you sit down and think about it, it's so true. You know, I don't try to dazzle people, that, you know, you just let them know that you're there to help them. And that's all that you can do for them. What would be a third one? Lesson learned. Enjoy the time that you have with your family, because you never know when the good Lord is going to take you away from this place. And Lord knows I've had some close ones there with my heart. So it's just something that, you know, you need to take care of yourself, take care of yourself and take care of your family. And do the things that are important, spending time with them.
Yeah, and I've one that you've taught us that I've stuck with me is you don't have to be the smartest person in the room. You just got to know him.
You got to know him. That's correct. That's correct.
So what is something you love about Louisiana?
Louisiana. My daughter and I had this conversation the other day. We were walking on the levee, and this just came to my mind. We were walking on the levee, and she was telling me that people don't understand the Louisiana culture. She's up in Colorado working and going to school up there, and she was trying to explain to this girl that was with her that the Mississippi River is across the street from our house, and this girl could just not fathom that. But just the culture and the lifestyle that we have here, the closeness of families is I think is different than any place that I've been to in the United States. I mean, you went with us when we went up to South Dakota. There's a lot of families up there, but it's still not the closeness that we had and that they look at us and say, you know, these people enjoy each other's company, and we do.
I mean, they got to drive 10 miles
to see
their neighbor,
to see the sun. You know, they got to drive 10 miles to see the sun. But I just think that, you know, in Louisiana, family's always been first, and people do things with their family and they cherish those memories. And that's something that I think that I would like to pass on, and hopefully that my kids have learned that, you know, family is important.
Yeah. So for the final question, what can I do to help you?
Be successful. be successful and don't move back home. Now, you can send your son and your kids, but, you know, I don't know, to help me just, again, just pass on the memories that we have of family to your kids, and keep that, you know, keep that going, because it's important. It just, you know, your kids need to know who your grandfathers were, who your great grandfathers were, and what they did on both sides. I don't care who they are. You know, they need to know. I mean, y'all are fortunate to have a grandfather that has been around, and he's been around your whole life. You know, I didn't have no grandparents basically from the time I was 6 years old on. So, you know, you want to cherish those memories, because there's things that they know that are dying, that they're just dying traditions. I mean, like the Cochon Delays, the things that he did in, you know, in Evolves Parish and that kind of stuff, the memories that you have with my mom and dad. So those are just things that, and you need to pass those on to your kids so that, you know, they can say, hey, I never knew great, you know, Momo Margaret, but this is what she used, the cocoons that we do.
Yeah.
You know, just the family traditions that we have, just to pass those on, keep those going in the family.
Yeah. And that's every intention that I've got. So
very good.
Thank you for coming on, Dad.
Thank you for having me. Happy Father's Day.
Happy Father's Day to you as well. And happy Father's Day to all those fathers listening. I hope y'all had a great weekend. And so thanks for coming on, Dad. Love you.
Thank you. Love you too.
And thank you, everybody else, for watching or listening to the show, whatever platform you're consuming us on. I hope y'all have enjoyed our Father's Day rendition this year. I don't know how we're going to top it next year, but we'll figure something out. And thank you as well to our lovely sponsors that bring you the show each and every week. Hear a little bit more about them right now.
Welcome to the brand new Philia mobile app. We took all the same tech that's helped hundreds of people sell their homes themselves and packed it into an easy-to-use app for your phone. When you download the Philia mobile app on either the Apple or Android App Store, you'll immediately be able to see the power of this game-changing tool. From the seller's dashboard, you can navigate to all the information that you need. We intentionally separated everything into key groups, such as tasks to be completed, buyer leads for your listing, and contact information for everyone involved through closing. When you get an offer on your property, you can simply review and respond all within the app. No matter where you are in the world, you'll be able to monitor everything that's going on with your property from listed to sold. It's truly the power of Philia in the palm of your hand. Download the app and see for yourself. Philia, it's real estate reimagined.
Thank you so very much to Building 5 for becoming the latest sponsor of the Patty G Show. We are going to be filming once a month at Building 5. We're going to post about it on our social so you can come and visit with us. Building 5 is an excellent food establishment if you're into sharing boards and really getting a creative menu. Misty and Brumby have done an excellent job of creating an environment that's warm, welcoming, and inviting for every single occasion. Go on over to Building 5 in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and tell them that the Patty G Show sent you.
Imagine taxiing on a plane looking toward the end of the runway. It seems so far away, it's even hard to see it. And that's what the concept of retirement probably felt like when you were in your 20s, 30s, and 40s, way far in the distance, not visible, or even a concern. But as you turn 50, something happens. Retirement suddenly seems like something real, something not too far away. In your 50s, you are rolling down the runway. Retirement is getting closer and closer, faster and faster, weeks and months zipping by. But are you even ready for a successful takeoff to retirement? Fear not, there's still runway left, but the time is now. Time to make progress, and time to get a plan. The Runway Decade will help you get organized, get energized, and give you the direction you need to take off to your desired retirement. The Runway Decade. building a pre-retirement flight plan in your 50s.
Thank you to Mercedes-Benz of Baton Rouge for making this show possible. Nick Pintus is a past guest. We love having him on. Listening to him talk about the culture they have over at Mercedes-Benz of Baton Rouge is really an incredible thing to hear. How they treat not only their employees, but every customer that walks through the door. You are more than just a number to them. They're going to give you that white glove concierge service every step of the way. They're going to make you feel like family and take what can be a stressful time in people's life, shopping for a car. They're going to make it so enjoyable and so pleasurable. You're going to want to go back there time and time again for every new vehicle. Thank you so very much for Mercedes-Benz of making this show possible. Thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Lake Men's Health Center, with Our Lady of the Lake Physicians Group. Guys, I know it's tough to get out and go to the doctor. I know it's challenging to find time in our busy days, but I promise you, signing up to be a part of this group with Dr. Curtis Chastain and Dr. Tyler Boudreaux, you won't regret it for several reasons, but most of those being the fact of the time it saves, where you're able to get in on the same day, get that appointment done, and spend that time you need to talk with them about what your health goals and concerns are, as well as ensuring that the financial investments you have, you will be able to live out and see those come to fruition. So if you're an investing guy, you know all about and planning for the future and investing in the future. There's no other more important thing to invest in than your health. Make sure you go check them out, Our Lady of the Lake Physicians Group Men's Health Center, and tell them Patty G sent you. McClavey's Limited, a proud sponsor of the Patty G Show, has been serving the Baton Rouge area proudly for 40-plus years. Gentlemen and ladies, if you're shopping for your man, there is no other place in the Baton Rouge area to get your clothing, whether it's game day needs, everyday needs, business attire, formal attire, whatever you want. Go over there, see Frank and Ashley. It's a father-daughter duo. They do incredible things in their store. They will outfit you from as simply a shirt that you need for one evening or all the way to a full wardrobe overhaul. They're going to take care of you every step of the way, and be sure and let them know that Patty G Show sent you. Thank you so very much to Currency Bank, a proud sponsor of the Patty G Show. If you're looking for a business bank that fosters on three core values, relationships, service, and technology, Currency Bank is the place for you. They pride themselves on convenient, accessible, and secure online banking resources where you can manage your account balances, initiate transfers, enroll with e-statements, and more via their online portal. Between the relationships, the service, and the technology, they are going to be that partner with your business every step of the way, regardless of what you need. Currency Bank is the bank for business owners. Oh, man, don't want a complication.